Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So we're about halfway through our winter retreat. Some people will be halfway. It's almost over. And some people think, oh, halfway, is that all? So it's depending on perception, depending on preference. But regardless of our feelings about it, it's halfway. It's there. And of course, we've been picking up the themes of the four foundations of mindfulness and various practices grounded in the four foundations of mindfulness. And I think it's important to pay attention to what those practices are for, in the sense of, we do contemplations of the body, contemplations of the elements, mindfulness of breathing, and those are skills that we cultivate and develop, but they also have a purpose or a goal, allowing us to see the nature of our experience more clearly and to come to a place of relinquishment, letting go. And in particular, I think being able to see the nature of our experience as not self, this fundamental teaching of the Buddhas that he points out, that the nature of our experience is not self. I mean, the tendency as human beings is to form a concept of self, a feeling of self, an assumption of self. And of course we keep suffering because the whole self construct and the self position, the I am position is completely inadequate to free oneself from suffering. I mean, it tries. I mean, it's a pathetic nature. But it's just by virtue of the fact of of truth, and just that sense of that self position, the I position. It's not up to the task of freeing oneself from suffering. It's up to the task for creating suffering. It's actually very adept at it. It's very good. I mean, the self position is very good for righteous indignation. It's great at that. Or jealousy, fear, grandiose ideas of gratification and distraction. Self is really good at that. Freedom from suffering, doesn't have a clue. It just doesn't. It's inadequate. And so that it's so that the Buddhist position is not one of, you have to annihilate the self or destroy the self. It's just you have to understand what its function is and what it what the result is, and then to see that there's an option. The option, of course, is this recognition of non-self, and then there's this kind of sense of ease. This was never self. It was never an I am. It never was anyway. So it's a tremendous sense of relief. So being able to reflect and investigate how one is just paying attention to what we assume to be self, and from the Buddha's how the Buddha presents it, the constellation of experiences that we create those assumptions of self are around the, say, physical form, in the sense of the body, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, the five khandhas, the five aggregates of being, so that to be able to reflect and investigate the nature of that, of those tendencies. And then also just the way that the Buddha outlines the basis of identification, what we identify with, and how we do it. So that taking the form or the body as self, or that form possesses self, form is in self, self is in form. The Buddha has this incredible, incisive way of attending and analyzing the assumptions that we make. And of course the same goes with the feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness itself. In the commentarial traditions, there's images that they give for that, say, form of self, in the sense of form as self, and that's similar to a flame and its color, as if they're one and the same, and that form possessing self, in the sense like a tree possessing a shadow. But they're really there. You know, they're dependent on each other. Form is in self, in a sense like the scent of a flower being in the flower. And self is in form, and something like a jewel in a casket. So that these are images to illustrate. It's just the assumption that we can make. And of course the same is these assumptions that we make around feeling and perception, mental formations, consciousness. You know, when we take, say, like taking the body as self, this is, say, I am the body, then, there's a tremendous disappointment when it changes, and when it gets sick, when it sort of refuses to heal, it's like, well, I think I'm just about over this cold. It's gone on forever. But if you look at it, well, it's just causes and conditions. So, you know, you do the best you can, trying to look after it. But if you assume it to be self, then it gets very problematic and deeply disappointing. This is where there's a discourse where the Buddha talks about agitation through clinging, so that when we cling to form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, and then say form changes, then, you know, we get disappointed, or we get upset by the fact that it has changed in a way that we don't like it. And when there is that impermanence being displayed and we don't like it, then it sets off a whole train of, the Bhikkhu Bodhi translates, a constellation of unwholesome states that arise because of that, and that worry, anxiety, fear, being upset at the body because it shouldn't be doing that. I mean, it should be young and healthy and vigorous. And say, well, good luck. Mm-hmm. and there's agitation because of clinging to form, wanting it to be a certain way, not wanting it to be another way. And of course, the same with feeling and perception, mental formations, the different aggregates. And we're just trying to make the different aggregates of our being follow our preferences, how we would like them to be, or trying to avoid how we don't want them to be. Like, yeah, we don't want to be ill, we don't want to be sick, we don't want to be old. But they follow their own path of nature. They have the causes and conditions. And this is the function of Dhamma, practicing Dhamma, is to learn how to accord with the causes and conditions, the way things are. And that there's a tremendous freedom in being able to accord with nature, with the way things are in nature. And then being able to recognize the limitations of the things that we do assume a sense of identity, a self-identity, an I am position. So that recognizing that in, say, yeah, in form, in the body, whether it's our own bodies, other bodies, other people's bodies, they're just form. A physical form. Feeling is the same. We have the and feeling in that from the Buddha's way of outlining it is pleasant, painful, neutral. It's that those fundamental feeling tones. Because we tend to react. The underlying tendency with pleasant feeling, of course, is to stimulate a sense of wanting, desire, preference. I mean, who doesn't prefer something that's pleasant? But it needs to be understood. If it's not understood, then we tend to, you know, we set up a sense of, you know, I am, say, I am this pleasant feeling, which is okay when pleasant feelings there, but it's an impermanent phenomenon. It changes, and you don't really have that much control. Even when you're, it was just like sitting meditation. Sit down, breathe in, breathe out, relax, let the body and the mind settle. It gets very pleasant. But it doesn't take that long. You can't sit there forever. It didn't take that long, and your painful feeling starts to manifest. Back starts to hurt, knees start to hurt, mind starts to get a bit restless after one's been sitting for a while. And all of a sudden, I've changed. My preference is what I thought I was. I was this pleasant feeling. It's changed into something unpleasant. But it's just following its nature. Or it shifts into kind of neutral. And then neutral is if we're not alert and attentive and mindful and understand the nature of a neutral feeling, then it has an underlying tendency of kind of delusion, or we tend to drift, and we're not sharp and clear, or the mind gets kind of spacey and drifty, because that's the underlying tendency. That's its nature. So that quality of mindfulness, alertness, attentiveness to the actual feeling that we're experiencing. And then just not assuming a sense of identity or permanence around that. By its very nature, it has to change. And the duty of a practitioner is to be present, to establish an understanding of that fundamental truth. And same with say, unpleasant and painful sensation. A painful sensation is the underlying tendency of aversion. Who likes painful sensation? I mean, it's just... But it's also, it's just as natural as anything else. There's nothing other feeling. And when there's aversion, then there's fear and ill will, resentment and agitation. But when it's not understood, when it's not seen clearly, when it's not seen through, and then when we, of course, when we try, when we possess it, when we assume an identity around it. But it's, I say, the nature of that non-self position is just a feeling is a feeling. Form is form. Perceptions are perceptions. They arise and they cease. And the mind isn't investing in it in the same way. It's just sort of willing to be present, willing to investigate, willing to recognize its quality, so that non-self position is a way of being able to meet our experience without being shaken by it, without being controlled by it. And perception is sort of memory, association. You know, we think memory is you know, we build our sense of self around memory, really. I mean, it's how we remember ourselves. That is our actual, our identity. Of course, it's malleable, changing. The function of memory is, you know, is very selective. You know, sometimes we'll choose memories and hold them, cherish them when it props up a sense of self-importance or self, you know, positive sense of self-idea. Or we'll choose memories that are kind of lean toward a negative self-perception and undermine a sense of well-being. But it's picking and choosing. It's memory is leaning in these different directions. But it's just a memory. But we create a sense of self around it, whether it's a kind of a happy self or a miserable self. And we're doing it. It isn't as if it's an actual reality. Function of memory is very selective and really uncertain. And over time, I mean, on a certain level, it's kind of scary. What is it that we have remembered? How have we remembered things? Like say for Americans, or particularly of a fairly recent generation, you know, who were you with on 9/11 when you heard about 9/11? And usually that's something that, yeah, we've got this vivid memory of being somewhere with having certain people around us. But then if you actually start talking with people, I'll bet your memory doesn't actually accord with reality. The other people might not be the same people who you actually thought, might not even be the same circumstance. But we form a memory. And we assume its reality, and we assume its existence. Or they've been doing experiments with memory and asking people, what's their first memory as children, and then people coming up with some kind of memory, and then they start to track it down, and it's actually it isn't a memory of something that happened. It's something that they saw when they were late in their later childhood, as a film, a video of a family video or something, and then they incorporate that into their memory of what they were, where they were, how they were at that time. That's how memory works. Yeah, so the way that we construct our sense of self. Like there's a right now in the news. Maybe this past week or so, there was this big kerfuffle of a news anchor, Brian Williams, I think, saying that when he was reporting in Iraq that he'd been in a helicopter that had been shot at and received damage, RPG damage. And the reality was that he'd actually reported it during that time, and it's on, it's on national coverage, where he'd been in the field. There was another helicopter that they were with, and of course it's then people say, how could this person? He's just a liar, and how could he do this? And outrage, but I don't think that people understand the nature of memory and the sense of self. Who knows? I mean, you can't really know until you actually understand the person's actual intention. But, the reality is, as human beings, something happens to us and, we start incorporating it. And it might have happened to somebody else, somebody happened to a friend, and happened in a circumstance. And you start repeating a story, and it starts to blur. It's sort of like the telephone game, you play as kids, and you start off, but you do that to yourself, and then you end up with a memory, even something. It's not inconceivable. Again, you can't know until you know the person's intention. But we can inhabit, one, other people's memories. We can inhabit the memories that we kind of confabulate of our own, because we're deluded. It's just the nature of. We don't really understand the true nature of phenomena, and it happens. So that it over time, how we create memory, or construe memory, or misconstrue memory, is really it's really malleable. And that's why it's so important to having mindfulness and clear comprehension and understanding how this sense of self can be taking form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, that these are not self. The scariest one that I heard of, it was a university professor. She's a forensic psychologist, and she started to do research into memory because she's been working with police and the justice system. And taking university students, normal, probably middle-class university students, and over a period of time, in interviews and talking to them, and introducing memories that these people pick up and assume into their kind of memory bank of what they did as children. It was like of course, university students at whatever age, or 20, 21, 22, young 20s, and then telling them that they've been in contact with their parents, and then at a period between 12 and 16 or something, introducing a memory of them having done, and not, you know, some innocent little thing, you know, oh, you told a white lie, blah, blah, blah. You know, assault with a weapon or theft, and that they researched, they had their friend, they introduced their friend, you know, had their name of their best friend and their circumstance, and the police were involved, and 71% of these university students incorporated that memory into their sort of perception. And you think, that's scary. You know, so that you know, if you, where's the boundary of, you know, this is definitely not self, and that's actually one of the, like that function of perception when it is supported by mindfulness and wisdom, is to be able to remember and to know what we've actually done and said, because it gets confused, it gets confabulated, it drifts, it gets complicated when it get that whole sense of self-perception, and depends, you know, how one's holding that sense of self, and what we filter out, what we put back in. And so that sense of really cultivating, one, of course, cultivating mindfulness and discernment, but then also cultivating the qualities that don't have a strong sense of that I am position around me. It's like, it's really interesting. You think in terms of you know, what has that feeling of self to it? I'm going to say, like, yeah, you know, like, yeah, kind of desire or jealousy or a sense of aversion. You know, that it quite immediately has this polarized sense of me and other, self and other, and something like. Compassion, loving kindness. It doesn't have the same sense of self, does it? It's just by its very nature. There's a dissolving of that, or not dissolving, but maybe a weakening of an expansive quality to that, the feeling of I am, or self-position. A gratitude is another one. Generosity is another one. Didn't have a lot of polarized sense of self and other. It's much more spacious. So just in a natural sense, the wholesome dhammas are extremely important to lay a foundation of, I mean, one, this well-being and happiness, but also one starts seeing quite tangibly the benefit of releasing and relinquishing that self-position. Without going to sort of Buddhist philosophy of the Buddha teaching the non-self position, blah blah blah. This isn't a philosophical position; it's a experience. When we lock into that self position, it is cramped. When we are able to turn our attention to more to the things that incline to that non-self, there's an expansion there. So that there's a well-being. This investigation of causes and conditions, how things work, how things are in their true nature. The teaching that the Buddha gives on non-self, and then that sense of stepping back from the holding to that, you know, or the forming that self-position in body, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, and however way, shape, or form. This is leading to happiness and well-being. There's an ease and possibilities of peace. So questioning the assumptions that we make from that self-position, and paying attention to the feeling tone that comes when we, how do we relate to, you know, physical form, body, feeling, perception, memory, thoughts, emotions, thoughts. I mean, if you want to get into a briar patch of dukkha, of the feelings of self, and of our thoughts. And they're just even so much more slippery and unreliable than being able to allow that sense of in reality, in truth, in following the nature of things. These are causes and conditions that arise and cease. Of course, we have to understand those causes and conditions. We have to see clearly. And then that learning how to utilize or rely on them, because mindfulness has causes and conditions. Confusion has causes and conditions. You want to be paying attention to what are the causes and conditions for well-being and happiness. What are the causes and conditions for peace and clarity? So this is the foundation of our practice, of our training, learning how to cultivate and develop. But this, you know, this non-self position is extremely practical. And as I said, the self position is just it's just inadequate for a goal of freedom from suffering. It's just is a poor substitute for reality. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.